This is how it is, man. I need to hit record on the actual podcast app so that we can put it on a podcast.
You're on it, my guy. Oh.
John, it has been quite the week, man. The Seahawks are in the Super Bowl, and it really doesn't feel like that. I don't know if it feels like it to you, but it feels like there's not been enough discussion on the Seahawks and being in the Super Bowl for me and not being in Seattle. Maybe it is for you, but I just wanted to put that out there. I feel like my Super Bowl discussion in my head is just all in my head. It's just me thinking about this game. So I have a lot of thoughts on this, and we're going to get to it today. Do you have anything to say before we dive into what's going to be a loaded podcast? The Mariners also traded for Brendan Donovan. We haven't even talked about that yet. We've got so much to talk about. Any thoughts from you before we get going?
It's big, man. Yeah, I'm sorry you're suffering from your Seattle expatriation. You know, the city is buzzing. There's lots of discussions, but our host here is stuck in St. Louis, where I cannot imagine a lot of people give a shit.
No, it's like my work colleagues are like, hey, congratulations, man. And that's about all I get. That's about all I get. So, yeah, we're going to be here talking about it. If you guys join live, we'll be happy to discuss any questions you guys might have. As always, we've been live on YouTube basically every pod for the last, I don't know, month and a half, 2 months. So if you're listening to this after the fact, check us out live on YouTube either Thursday or Wednesday nights. We usually start around 4 p.m. Pacific time, so you can check us out there. We'll give you a little coyote picnic right here, but we'll stay live on YouTube. Been a while since I left this town. Okay, John, what do you want to dive into first? Like, the Mariners, obviously, huge Brendan Donovan trade. Do we want to save the Seahawks? Do we want to talk a little bit of other stuff? Obviously, I haven't really given you a lot of shit for this, but your Zags lost to the University of Portland Pilots last night.
We're going to talk about it, okay? Let me use to bring it up before we're going to talk about it. Let's save the Seahawks for last, because I think that'll be our most rambling conversation. I say let's start with the Nerds, knock out the rest, and then we can finish with the Hawks.
Sounds good. So, Mariners news, a huge trade for Brendan Donovan. We all kind of like, it, you know, the tidbits were being spread all throughout Mariners fandom and throughout the MLB that, hey, the Mariners are going to make a big move. They just, you know, whether it was going to be a free agent signing or this Brendan Donovan trade was still up in the air. And I think after Gino Suarez went off the board, it was like, okay, guys. And then Jerry DePoto and co were just like, I think it's kind of time we can send a little bit of the farm over there. So I'm going to break down the trade real quick, but I do want to hear just your immediate thoughts. The Mariners acquired Brendan Donovan. How are you feeling about that?
Great. I feel great about it. Pros and cons of the trade to talk about, but I am mostly just excited that there was a real moment of fear that nothing was going to happen, nothing of substance. This is a move of substance. It deepens our lineup in a really real way. We can argue all day and night about value. Just exciting for me to see management make a trade of this magnitude when I was starting to get pretty nervous that it was going to be all quiet.
Yeah, I think I'm in the exact same boat. I was like, freaking finally, man. I didn't even really care what we sent over. Obviously, I wouldn't have wanted, you know, one of the top Colt Emerson type guys to go. But looking at what we sent over and you know, kind of the entirety of the trade, I'm actually pretty happy with what happened. So let me break it down real quick. We get obviously Brendan Donovan. He's kind of a infielder, outfielder guy. He can play basically anywhere you need him to. So that's really nice for the Mariners and their flexibility. And then we sent out Gerangelo Sinche, who is a switch pitcher, which was very, very weird. He's got a really nice right-handed slider, good heat coming from the right side. I think he was upper 90s, touching like 99 through 97. And then his left-handed side still needs some work, but overall, he's a top prospect, top 100 prospect. And then we sent outfielder Ty Peet, he kind of was drafted as a shortstop, I think, and he's transitioned to the outfield, but he's our number 11 prospect. And then the Rays were included in this. We sent them Ben Williamson, who was obviously our third baseman for a lot of last season. And we sent one competitive balance round B pick, which was pick number, I wrote that down wrong. It's pick number 68 from the Mariners. So that's just like the 68th pick. That's the competitive balance round, happens between the second and third rounds of the MLB draft. And so they would have a pick there that the Mariners sent to the Cardinals. So that's a lot that I just said. What immediately kind of shines to you when I say all those names?
Just that this is a scenario, and you know, I've heard some various opinions on this trade, but this is a scenario where you're trading four quarters for a dollar or something like that. And in the history of professional sports, the team getting the dollar always wins those trades. You know, you always hear best player in the trade, that team won. This is a scenario where far and away, he is clearly the best asset. And you know that because, you know, one team got just him and the other team's got a smattering of picks and prospects and young players. It's just pretty clear that, in my opinion, you know, just based on the fact that it was a lot of smaller pieces for a bigger piece, that this was a winning trade.
Yeah, I think immediately I look at that and I say, okay, Sanja's a good player, but he's not a top-of-the-line starter guy. Like, he is probably going to be a reliever, and maybe the Cardinals think they can stretch him into a starter that can go, you know, from both sides of the mound, I guess, is kind of a weird way to put that, but to go from both sides of the mound with both hands. But all things considered, like, he's not a top guy. He's not your, like, Ryan Sloan, another Mariners prospect. He's going to be a starter, probably, like, you know, he's projected to be a number three starter, but like, he could be as high as a number two or number one starter. Like, just his frame, the type of pitcher that he is. Sange is not that kind of guy. He's more of a kind of spinner with a little bit of heat. I kind of think of him as a Matt Brash, but from both sides of the mound, which is nice, but it's not a top prospect when you really think of it that way. So yeah, Brendan Donovan's really nice here. He's a batting average king, right? He's hit, I think, 280 last year. He hit 287 last year, 353 on base, 422 slug. And the slug is really kind of the surprising thing. That's a pretty good slugging ratio for somebody who's in the 13th percentile in bat speed, right? This is a guy who doesn't hit the ball super, super hard, but he squares it up very, very frequently. So really just good, solid things coming from him. And he is a guy that's just going to be on base, right? 353 on base means he's probably going to hit in the upper part of your lineup, and he's going to be on base for Julio, for Cal, for these guys, and that's just going to be so nice. To touch on his splits real quick, he's much better hitting against righties than he is versus lefties. He only had 169 appearances versus lefty, 169 appearances versus lefties, and 346 versus righties. So he's a righty king, hit 230 against lefties and 315 against righties. So those are things to keep in mind when you're looking at how this guy's going to play in terms of the entirety of the season that he's on the roster, but he's just a really solid on-base guy.
Yeah, we can get a little bit more into the conversation of, was it an overpay for a guy like this? But I just want to state, you know, my main thesis for why I'm so excited about this guy is, you know, he's been playing in the big leagues for 4 years now. In those 4 years, he has been as consistent as any player I think I've ever seen. Where it's just statistically pretty amazing how consistent he's been. In four seasons of Major League Baseball, his average has finished every year between 278 and 287. His on-base percentage has finished every year between 342 and 365, slugging between 417 and 422. He is just living in these ranges every single year, which, you know, for a team that has a bad history of bringing in guys and their performances falling off, just makes me a little bit more comfortable that he's been doing it over and over and over. I'm not expecting him to play better in Seattle. I'm expecting him to bat about 282 and slug about 411 like he's been doing for the last 4 years.
Yeah, I think, go for it.
Well, I was just going to say, with that being said, you know, I'm in a lot of group chats, hearing a lot of chatter about this trade, and I do think there's been a little bit of like, wow, why did we give up so much for this guy? You know, couple top-tier prospects, number 68 overall pick, Ben Williamson, some people like. Can you make the case? You know, I kind of pshawed at that response, but can you kind of make the case why this could potentially be an overpay?
Yeah, definitely. A little bit, you're looking at it, and it's 1 year of a guy for what is essentially like 10 years of prospect value there. When it comes to Sanja, is going to be a guy who can be in the major leagues for, you know, 4 years before they really have to pay him anything. So that's a lot of value there. And as soon as this season's over, he's making $5.8 million this year. As soon as this season's over, he's a free agent. Or I guess he hits ARB3 and then he's a free agent after the next year. But like, the Mariners have to figure out how much to pay him next year. There's no set contract right now. So he might be requesting a lot, who knows, but it's the sense of like, yeah, you always say bird in the hand versus, a bunch of guys that are on the sideline, in this case, in the minors. So obviously it's nice to have Brendan Donovan, but people get, it's kind of the Harry Ford situation where people get super excited about the, I guess, idea of a prospect coming. People are super excited about the idea of the Mariners having a switch pitcher who can, you know, throw from both sides in T-Mobile Park. That's so cool to think about. And then you think about, I don't know how many people actually know who Ty Pete is. Ty Pete's a pretty good athlete. He's a really solid player. I was kind of thinking that like he would be the type of person that we would let go, would be him or kind of a Michael Arroyo type. So I was not surprised that he was the number two piece. But to send Ben Williamson out, I think was surprising to a lot of people because he's been our everyday third baseman. There's been no development when it comes to signing a third baseman besides people thought Gino was going to be it. So the fact that Gino was off the board and now you send over Ben Williamson, it's like, okay, either Brendan Donovan's going to be playing third or it's going to be like Cole Young and Colt Emerson, two relatively unproven guys, which I think is the reason that people are surprised and think it might be an overpay just because of the loss of Ben Williamson. And, you know, he's a controllable piece. So all of that is to say, it's a fair statement to say 1 year of a guy for 10 to 12 years of prospects is a little bit scary of a price.
Sure. No, I definitely appreciate that. Worth saying that Brendan does have experience at third base, 46 career games at third base, so it wouldn't be crazy to see him slide over there. I guess, yeah, and when you stack everything up, there is the case for the overpay. I also didn't realize we're only going to have control for two more years before, you know, having to let him become a full-fledged free agent. With that being said, I'm such a bird in the hand guy. You know, Ben Williamson has only played, you know, one full season in the big leagues last year. Decent volume, 277 at-bats, 253 average, 310 slugging. Really did not show a lot when it comes to generating power. Only one home run. And, you know, he's a young player for sure. But before Ben came up, he would have been the highest ranked of these prospects. If he hadn't played this last season, you know, if he was still listed as a prospect in the Mariners farm system, he would be the highest ranked of any of these prospects that we traded. And we've seen what MLB Ben Williamson looks like. And he's a guy that, I think he'll carve a role out for himself in the league. I don't think he's ever going to be an all-star. You know, people grow, people develop, but I haven't seen it from him where I'm like, okay, this guy's going to be able to either generate enough consistency with his at-bats or improve his power enough to really be a difference maker. So it's just an example of like, you don't know what these guys are going to be at the next level. I will almost always say, give me the guy that's proved it.
Yeah. The one thing that concerns me with that is we did send him to the Rays, who just have a history of being really great at developing people that they trade for. But,
well, and I'd be happy for Ben. You know, no shade for Ben. He can come back when he's a free agent. I'm just saying.
Yeah. No, he's such a plus defender that he, like you said, he'll carve out a role no matter what. Like, he will have a spot on an MLB roster for the foreseeable future. But yeah, I think he hit two home runs last year, one home run.
In 277 at-bats.
Yeah, Brendan Donovan hit 10 last year. He's basically a 10 to 15 home run guy. Like,
that's
a lot more value that you're getting. What, you know, if we say, hey, you're playing third base, that's 10 to 15 more home runs every single year for the next 2 years. And that's just so much more value. And listen, the Mariners are trying to win the World Series. Like, this is the time that you're like, hey, we can get rid of the prospects. Like, we don't need to have the best farm system. We're trying to win the World Series right now. It's like, I don't know. It's like when you're playing Dynasty Fantasy Football and you need to make a trade to go get the best player, that's the best running back or whatever it is, and you need to trade five guys and two first-round picks, and you're like, I don't care. I'm going to net my $400 profit, and that's going to be the win for me for the next decade. Yeah. That's what the Mariners are going for right now.
Learn from the Golden State Warriors. The two timeline thing is idiotic. When you have your shot, you have to unload the bag and take your shot. And you know what? Maybe you're going to miss. And then you just got to rebuild and try again sometime. But the idea that's like, oh no, we're going to try to win it naturally just with the talent we have and develop and draft. And we're never going to trade any prospects because those are our stars of the future. It's like, well, great, man. This is Seattle. You're not New York or Los Angeles. Good luck. So I do appreciate it. It's like, no, at some point you got to take a swing.
It's kind of like being in the perpetual state of contention that the AL Central just as a whole has always been in. It's like the Twins were great for 7 years there, but they never were like amazing. The same things happened with the Guardians, you know, the Tigers are kind of doing the one thing and going all in, and it's like, okay, the Tigers are a little scary with their signings that they've made and everything like that. It's like they're finally doing something different out there in the Central.
But even them, dude, Skubal was on the trade block. Apparently the cost was pretty abhorrent to other teams, but he was being served up if anybody wanted to come by him. So even the Tigers, it's like, come on, guys. Do you want the best guys, or do you want to turn every great player into, you know, do you want to turn every dollar you have into five quarters and then say you won the trade? I just don't know about it.
Yeah, I think the Skubal thing was interesting because I never really thought they were going to trade him. I think it was a like, hey, if you offer us the moon, yes, we will trade you Tariq Skubal because you get 1 year of him. If you want to try and extend this guy, he's asking for $50 million a year. but at the end of the day, like, I think they never really had an intention of trading him, and they might, you know, he's going to be a free agent next year, or maybe they'll trade him at the trade deadline. But at the end of the day, this is their contention window too. Like, I doubt they want to get rid of the arguably best pitcher in baseball. So we'll see what they do. I think they would have taken the moon, but I don't think anybody was willing to do that for 1 year of Skubal. Yeah.
I think they were asking for $5 and quarters is what they wanted. Yeah. No team was willing to do that for a year.
They were like, hey, can you send me a $2 bill and then just like 12 quarters?
Crazy.
All right. That is all we've got on the Mariners for right now, unless you want to touch on anything else.
I guess my question for you is, and because you just know where these guys fit better than I do, would your assumption be that Brendan's just going to slide right into third base, or do you think there's going to be a shuffling of the infield?
That's a great question. I think what it'll be is the Mariners will give him, Cole Young, and Colt Emerson all reps at third base and second base and do more or less a kind of platoon situation. The problem is, we don't currently, that I can think of, I need to look at the Mariners depth chart actually real quick, but I can't currently think of a right-handed hitting player that would play third or second base right now. I guess it's probably Ryan Bliss. Ryan Bliss is probably the guy who would be our right-handed hitting second baseman or third baseman. Maybe they think they can move him. Let me look at the depth chart real quick. But yeah, I think it's Ryan Bliss is probably like the right, when we go up against a left-handed pitcher, that's going to be our little bit of a scary time, I think would be my statement.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, it's like Leo Rivas, switch hitter, but like he can play some, obviously, shortstop if he needs to, but he's probably going to play a little bit of second, a little bit of third. Miles Mastrobuoni, our favorite guy, but he also hits left. But I would expect that he will be our, you know, backup third baseman by the time the season starts.
Mr. Do It Himself, keep him off the field. that makes sense. So it does not sound like you're expecting something to be very solid and very consistent day to day. You think it'll bounce around quite a bit?
Yeah, I'm in the camp of it's going to be whatever the Mariners can make do in those spots because the fan base was clamoring for this move, and we'll see what happens this season. Maybe they have another move in front of them. Maybe they have another idea for something, but there's not a ton of great third basemen out there, so we'll see if they can slot one in. I think they're relying on Cole Young to take a leap forward this year, and then Colt Emerson to have a decent rookie campaign.
Well, we can hope. Would you, I guess, just out of curiosity, because these two guys are basically even in my mind, if you could have kept either Cole Young or Ben Williamson, would you have picked one over the other?
Definitely Cole Young. Cole Young as a hitter is so much better than Ben Williamson. And defensively, like, you can be great, but defense doesn't get you to be an all-star level player. Like, hitting gets to that point. Cole Young's hit tool, and we saw he hit the longest home run on the entire Mariners roster last year. Like, Cole Young has the power if he can handle the ball. Like, he's got 10 to 20 home run power if he can get consistent at the plate. So I'm excited for him. And happy that he's going to get a little bit longer of a leash this year.
Totally. And so much of baseball defense, in my opinion, has always been effort-driven. Obviously, you can still be good or bad, but so much of it, in my mind, is just what you're willing to do. And he strikes me as a guy that's willing to work for it.
Yeah. All right. Quickly, we're going to move through the other sports, and then we'll move to the Seahawks and the Super Bowl preview. So we've got the Kraken, who, again, have gone 3-1-0 since we last talked. They're now 27-20-9. Sitting 1 point out of the second place spot in the Pacific Division of the NHL. It's nice that they're doing well, I suppose. They're 6-2 in their last eight games, which is pretty nice to see. But at the same time, I looked at the standings for the first time and I was like, man, they've got 63 points or whatever it is, but they would not be top five or top four in any other division. So it doesn't necessarily make me super happy that they're really fringe contending in the Pacific.
Yeah, I credit where it's due. That's now 6-2-0 in the last eight games. That's an impressive stretch. They've been doing it against the Pacific, largely. You know, they tallied wins against the Knights, the Ducks, and the Kings this week, which helped them jump both the Ducks and the Kings in the standings. Still, technically, two games under 500, as opposed to, you know, the Ducks are four games over. Kings are actually way below 500. It's amazing, these overtime losses, how it can change the standings, but... yeah, I would love to see the win column continue to increase. I want to get to 30 wins. But, you know, they're doing their job right now, and I do appreciate that.
Yeah, they're climbing back up in goal differential too, right? Just looking at the general, like, table when you're looking at the NHL, it's like, oh, the best teams in each division are like plus 50 to plus 30 to plus 74, and then in the Pacific Division the Golden Knights are plus 9 at the number one spot in that one, and the Kraken are minus 3, and they have the third best goal differential in the Pacific. So that's kind of where things are in the Pacific Division. It's just kind of a brutal one. None of these teams are very good. We will see what the Kraken are able to do.
The Ducks, who are in fourth, are the only team with a winning record in the Pacific. But they're fourth because all their losses are in regulation. Only three overtime losses, far and away the most in the division.
Classic. Friggin' Canada, man. Sending everything to overtime gets you points. What are we talking about?
Socialized point systems, man. Not for me.
All right, let's quickly jump to college basketball, where it's finally time to talk about it. We're going to jump right into it. John, what happened last night? Yeah. The Gonzaga Bulldogs lost to the University of Portland Pilots.
Yeah, go Pilots, first of all, first and foremost. I've always been a Pilots fan. Everybody knows that.
I almost went there.
Yeah, almost went to Portland. I had this conversation with a couple of people yesterday about, is this the worst regular season loss in the history of Gonzaga basketball? And I think there's a real chance that it is. To be the number six team in the nation with your only loss coming to arguably the best team in the country in Michigan, and then to lose your second game to the Portland Pilots in Portland is just pretty embarrassing. And the crazy thing is it's just so apparent what an effort loss it was. Like, there's nothing you can point to make excuses. Offense did all right. We scored 80 points. They only hit 7 three-pointers. It's not like they were just bombing us from three. They did not shoot more free throws than us. They got one more rebound than us. They turned the ball over almost twice as many times as we did, and they committed one more personal foul. So there was nothing that you could point to say, oh, this turned the game. It was just a total scenario of this team walking in, sleepwalking into Portland, not bringing it for basically the entire game, and getting their butts kicked by a Portland team that is now 11-14. So this was pretty humiliating. There are lots of people that you can blame. Basically, all our starters, with the exception of Graham Ike, just had a no-show of a performance. Really, really disappointing.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, Graham Ike is the only person who kept you guys even remotely in this game. He played 35 minutes on what I would assume is still a little bit of bum of an ankle or whatever that injury was. Yeah. And he dropped 24 points on 9-16. Like, he had a pretty solid game, 24-10-3. Like, that's a good game by him. The rest of the guys, you guys shot 40% from the field on 65 shots, 10 of 30 from three. Like, the Portland Pilots shot 16 total three-pointers. They were 32 of 54 from the field. They just shot 60% from the field, 44% from three, and 80% from the free throw line. And it's just like, they took 11 less shots than you. Like, they just, I was trying to figure it out because I was like, why did you lose this game? And it did feel just a lot like an effort loss. Like, nobody really seemed to want to take a hold of this game. You know, you think of the guys like a Steel Venters goes 2 of 7 from three, and it's like, maybe you can account that to him just being off that day. But it's like, somebody has to be on. Like, you're playing the Portland Pilots and nobody is able to go score besides Graham Ike. You're like, Tyon Grant Foster was a 20 point per game scorer last year, wasn't he? Like, nobody wanted it.
Well, and you know, the bench brought a little bit more energy, a little bit, but you can tell a few got so frustrated, basically pulled the starting lineup about halfway through the first half and was done with them. I mean, these were season low in minutes for Innocenti and Worley and Adam Miller. Like, these guys just hardly played, and it's because it was just so clear the effort they were bringing was negligible. Yeah, Innocenti, 0 for 5, 0 for 3 from 3, 0 points in this game in 13 minutes. So, it was nice to see.
Literally a non-factor. He had 0 points, 2 rebounds, and 1 assist. That was all he did. Yeah. No steals, no nothing.
Yeah. Our four-man bench rotation, Grant Foster, Fogle, Super A, and Venters, were all our minutes leaders behind Grant Mikay. So it's clear he just did a full pivot to the bench. Didn't even really work. I mean, they had a little bit of a comeback at the end. There was an outside chance that they could have tried to steal this one. They were down like 18 at one point and cut it to 5, I think, and missed an open 3 that could have cut it to 2. But they didn't deserve this game. The Pilots deserved it because they just played a lot harder. And I did just want to shout out to Joel Foxwell, who went off 11 of 18, 27 points for the 6'1" guard. How on earth we didn't just put Jalen Worley on him and just say, end this guy's career, is mind-boggling to me. But he cooked us, so credit where it's due.
Yeah, I mean it was also a game where the Pilots starters just like never came out. Like they were like, "Hey, we're hitting shots. We took an early lead. We can win this game, like,
guys.
Let's
we're
do
up on
this.
The number 6 team in the country." Yeah, shout out to Borland. I'm certain this is the biggest win in their program history, which is amazing for them. Got it. Love to see it. Huge, huge win for the WCC before Gonzaga slinks away.
But yeah, we have to call out the Bulldogs where credit needs to be taken. And I want to ask you where you think they'll fall to here, probably in the rankings.
Well, in the rankings, it's going to be a big hit. There were a couple teams like Michigan State lost to Minnesota, which was an embarrassing loss, but obviously not on par with this. They're definitely going to drop out of the top 10. I would say they'll still be in the top 15, I would guess, just because, you know, again, net rating wise, they're still like the second best team in the country. This was just an all time embarrassing loss. I think where it's really going to hurt them is on the seed line when the tournament comes around. They can kiss the 2 seed goodbye. No way they're giving a 2 seed to a team that lost to the Portland Pilots. So now I think it's a quest to grab a hold of the 3 seed and avoid the 4 or 5 line, which is, you know, on the table with another loss.
Yeah, and if you get to that point, you're the classic Gonzaga lining themselves up to battle the number 1 seed as they always try to do early. Yeah. They always want to do that. So.
And we're going to get Michigan and we're going to get our butts kicked. I can already taste the humiliation.
I will say, this is the kind of team that it's a question defense or offensively. Like, obviously their defense has been so good and you guys were touting their defense early on, you and Rosenberger, and I just, for a team that has 2 very efficient scorers from the interior, like, I expected more from the backcourt. Like, Tyon Grant Foster has been kind of meh all season. He's been like an 11-point per game scorer. Steel Ventures has been 5 points per game. Like,
Steel's
I
been
just
awful.
Feel like
his injury, obviously 2 lower leg injuries. You never know what you're going to get, but he's not really a D1 player. There was a lot of talk yesterday about how he's just untenable defensively and he's not hitting his threes. It's like I feel bad for the guy, but he has no purpose on the court. So I would just rather give all those minutes to Fogle.
Yeah, that's how I feel playing with my bum ankle sometimes.
It is tough. You know, the other undercut part of just this season is that all of the Zags' good losses are just diminishing in value. You know, Alabama's fallen out of the top 25. Kentucky's not going to sniff it. Just a lot of their early season wins where we're like, look at that, that's a great win, are becoming less and less impressive. So that's going to hurt both in the immediate term and when it comes to seeding.
Yeah. Oh, anyways, we can jump to some other Washington teams. UW had the lead against Iowa at halftime, and they ended up losing that by like 10. Their second half was not very good in that one. They are now 12-11, and I think that one kind of seals the deal. There was a world where, you know, if they kind of won out and beat a lot of these, you know, middling to bad Big Ten teams, they could make the tournament as like a 11 seed, maybe. But I think the ship has sailed on that one.
Good night, Sweet Prince. Yeah, it was a fun season. It'll be interesting to see what happens next year. But we'll still talk about UW because they're just a little more interesting than Washington State. But I do believe they're joining the Cougs in the category of season ended early.
Yeah, unfortunately, Wazoo 11-14. Did they beat Portland? Do we have to bring that up? Did Wazoo beat
everybody's
Portland?
Everybody's beating Portland. That is, yeah, I'm sure you're right.
Oh, they played last week. I think it was like the Portland trip through the Wazoo and Gonzaga area.
I'm pulling it up right now. Yes, they beat Portland by 30.
Jesus Christ!
Yeah,
Portland was that was a look ahead game. Portland.
Yeah. They gobsmacked Portland.
Portland was locked in on that Gonzaga game.
It gave up 104 to Washington State, but we can't score more than 80. So, yeah, tough one. They also held Portland to 13 less points. So, yeah, pretty embarrassing.
Crazy. All right, John, it's time. Super Bowl preview session. Let's do it. Before we get started, I just want you, it's been a week since we last talked. I want you to walk me through anything, any changes through what, you know, kind of your thought process for what you think is going to happen. What do we like? What's been our news that we've heard in terms of Seattle? Like, what's been going on for you?
Yeah, it's been a fun week. Obviously, all the Super Bowl preview stuff, all the interviewing, it's all been good stuff for sure. We're going to talk about some injury stuff on both sides that have become big stories in this last week. I will just say the amount of 2015 rematch stuff that has been going around, you know, all revenge tour for the Seahawks to avenge that horrible one. Please stop reminding us. We all remember we literally have a guy in my dynasty league, a good family friend, who has been in our dynasty league for 10 years, whose name, he never changes his team name, and it's Run the Damn Ball. It's Run the Damn Ball, and it's been that ever since they chose to throw it on the one-yard line. And he has it every year. We know what a terrible loss that was. Please stop bringing it up. There's nobody on this team that was there for that happening, nor is there anybody on the Patriots. Let's just stop talking about it. It's just a painful memory, and it makes Patriots fans giddy every time we bring it up. But other than that, I think the big stories in terms of, you know, how it could affect the game are the Amanwari injury for the Seahawks and the Drake May shoulder for the Patriots. So why don't you run down what your thoughts are there?
Well, let me real quick shout out the Run the Damn Ball situation, because I think the NFL just doesn't really know where to go with this game. Like, they've been a little like, hey, this is Sam Darnold versus Drake May. Drake May is kind of an unproven guy, and yeah, Sam Darnold is Sam Darnold. So it's like, who do we grapple onto for selling this game? And it's like, oh, we have to kind of say this is a revenge tour. This is the angle that the entire media public has taken for this game. And we're not going to take that angle, but that is why that is happening.
Yeah, and they're trying to foist it upon us too. So like, then if the Seahawks blow it, it's like, oh, they blew it again. It's like, man, this is a different team.
Yeah.
I will say one thing on that. We'll talk about it with the Drake May injury too, but I'm sure nobody is more disappointed, even more than Patriots fans, with how horrible Drake has been this postseason than media talking heads. Because, again, he was in the MVP conversation. I know it's a regular season award, but any chance he had, he killed with his playoff performance. Nobody. It was like, oh, Stafford, Drake's got some better stats. Should we give it to him? It's like, he was so bad in their playoff run. Nobody could justify giving him MVP. And I'm sure they would love to talk about, like, is this the ascendancy of Drake May we're watching? But you can't do that after three straight games of him thrown for, like, 150 yards and two picks.
I literally, there's been articles that I've been reading, and it's like, hey, Drake May should win the MVP. And it's like, that feels like an argument that should have been made 3 weeks ago, and now it feels moot. Like, I don't need to worry about Drake May being the MVP right now. It doesn't feel like that's going to happen. Like, the impacts of what all has been transpiring over the last few weeks with Drake May has just made his, even if the voters don't want to count it, it's like, then it's just a statistical award. Like, the media literacy and everything with that matters.
Yeah. So it's not supposed to matter, but when it's this visual, I mean, he would have been better served just losing in the first round so people could say it was one game. But the fact that it's been, it's just been bad. You know what's, it's really helped is Vrabel's coach of the year argument. I bet you that might have locked him in on coach of the year.
Honestly, this is the coach of the year game right now. This is like Mike McDonald versus Mike Vrabel. That's a great coach of the year debate.
It's the year of the Mikes, there's no doubt.
Yep. All right, so let's jump into some of the injuries that you talked about. So obviously we heard earlier this week Nick Amonwori has, I believe it was an ankle injury. I think it was a little questionable what exactly it was, but he limped off the field under his own power. You know, a couple of people were walking with him, asking him questions, making sure he was okay. But he was able to get off the field, just, you know, tender ankle. And then the other one is Drake May's shoulder, as you alluded to. Drake May's had a little bit of a tight shoulder. There's been some questions about how much that's going to impact his throwing and that stuff during this game. What are your thoughts about kind of those two specific injuries? And then we'll dive into maybe some other ones. Like, I believe Cross, the left tackle, was out in the second half of the NFC Championship. So there's been some discussion about how he's going to do.
Yeah. The Amonwori injury was definitely very concerning, just because of how short the timeline was between that injury and the Super Bowl. This happened like 3 or 4 days ago that he got hurt. And people were just like, how is he going to play so soon? Even if it's, you know, there's no structural damage or anything like that. It was really just a twisted ankle. But there was a lot of concern. And there were some, you know, NFL doctors coming out and being like, do not expect him to play. It's just too short of a window. Since then, both he and Coach McDonald have come out and said, like, no, he's going to play. You can count on it. I think the question now is, how close to 100% is he going to be? And my guess is he won't be 100%. But he is, you know, he's probably going to win Defensive Rookie of the Year. He's obviously very impactful. So while it's going to be a small hit not to have him at full strength, I'm just very glad to hear. And, you know, they'll get him filled with bath salts or whatever it is that they're giving these players with injuries. Some of those perks that Rodgers was having.
Shoot him up with adrenaline.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll play fine. But, yeah, I think that concern's been pretty well alleviated. But that was a big moment there.
Yeah, there's a lot of this defense is kind of listed on the, hey, they're injured, but also just kind of taking a rest. Obviously, Ernest Jones, Josh Jones, DeMarcus Lawrence, Julian Love, they've all had some stuff that's like, hey, be careful. But I really think they're just resting. The one that I alluded to is Charles Cross. He's expected to play, which is very, very nice as the left tackle. So all things considered, we're looking pretty solid here on the injury front for the Seahawks besides Nick Amonwori. I think that was the big news. And I think that was the big news because everybody was like, what makes this Seahawks defense so good? And everybody kind of realized that it was Nick Amonwori and Devin Witherspoon just being insane athletes. So any injury to them is a little scary. But I think he'll be just fine, as we said. He'll deal with that injury in whatever way the Seahawks need to. Jumping to next discussion, the Drake May thing. And I really wanted to talk about this because the Seahawks kind of did it with Sam Darnold's oblique, and I think in general NFL teams are doing this right now, and I don't think anybody wants to admit it. The NFL has an issue with just like making its quarterback like padding its quarterbacks, because if it just feels like if a team loses, they're going to say, oh, our quarterback was injured. That's what it feels like to me. They don't want their teams to fail, or their players to fail, these teams, because if the Seahawks are like, oh, Sam Darnold lost the NFC Championship, he can't win bad games, and they don't have the injury to blame, it's like, okay, it was just Sam Darnold's fault. And it feels like that's kind of what's happening with the Patriots and Drake May's injury. It's like, hey, we didn't win this game because Drake May's shoulder was injured, and so now we're trying to protect him from the scrutiny of the media. It's kind of what I've been feeling like with these injuries that just every quarterback is dealing with every single week. Yeah. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a great point. You know, especially something like shoulder soreness. It's like, yeah, dude, no duh. You got sacked like 7 times against the Broncos. I'm sure you're sore in a lot of places, but is that an injury? You know, or is that more of, you know, just something bugging you? Obviously, yeah, the Seahawks had the exact same thing. That oblique turned into a whole lot of nothing. I wonder if any of it is just like, and you know, I couldn't really argue with this, but you know, psychologically positive, where it's like, hey, we're just trying to take a little pressure. We know you're dealing with an oblique. We know you're dealing with a shoulder. We're just going to put it out there so that you just feel a little more comfortable going out. You know, you go out and you miss a throw, they're going to be blaming it on the oblique and not you. You know, get back into your rhythm. But it does seem, quarterbacks are so finely tuned instruments. I think people are naturally a little more careful. But yeah, this is the second one in a row that's just been a complete non-issue. He missed like 2 practices, but you know, last Friday he was taking reps without any apparent issues or setbacks, so he's gonna be fine. He's certainly gonna play. And again, we can pretend all we want that they're not giving these players things to help manage pain, but they are. He might be extra sore the day after the Super Bowl, but that's not gonna matter. So, yeah, I do think it's a non-issue for the game. Little missed practice time, I guess, is the only thing to be taken away from it. You know, he's a guy that probably needed all the practice he could get, considering how poor he was playing. But I don't really think this
talk
is
your shit, John.
But he's been awful. He's been terrible the last 3 games.
Yeah,
it's the Patriots. Didn't have the one really nice throw to Booty, but stupid. This is Rex Grossman in the Super Bowl type nonsense.
It is one of those things where I was thinking about this, and I even pulled up some like history of the Super Bowl notes to talk about this, because the Seahawks winning this Super Bowl, and again, maybe it's because I'm not in Seattle and maybe it doesn't feel as big and the people that I'm around are just not talking about it as much, but this Super Bowl just doesn't feel as big as it has in the last maybe decade, just because it's two quarterbacks that are not necessarily the highest end of the talent spectrum as of right now when it comes to like the NFL's selling point for them, right? Last year you had Eagles, Chiefs. Obviously anything with the Chiefs is going to be a bigger game because of Mahomes, but it's like the Eagles had been a super great defensive team. Jalen Hurts, Saquon Barkley, like that was a huge year for them. And then the year before you had the Niners versus the Chiefs, and that's just a great, like, you know, San Francisco and again the Chiefs matchup. Chiefs, Eagles the year before that, Rams, Bengals. Like this feels kind of like a random year. And for that reason, I want to ask you, will it feel any cheaper if the Seahawks win this one?
I completely disagree. I think that is maybe more of a factor of you just being out of the system. But, you know, I've been listening to enough national stuff to know that the Patriots fans are very excited and enough local stuff to know that Seahawks fans are very excited. I mean, again, you know, if the Patriots win, there's just going to be a discussion of like, man, what a weird postseason for them. Because, again, if they win this one, I think Drake May is going to have to play well. And it's like, oh, man, he just saved it for the Super Bowl. Cool. But if the Seahawks win, you know, credit to the Pats where it's due. They're definitely one of the best defenses in the NFL. They've been the one or two seed in the AFC all year. So you got the one overall seed in the NFC meeting the two overall seed in the AFC. These are two great teams. And the Hawks have had a heck of a road getting here, getting through the Niners and the Rams. So I don't think it counts any less. I think the quarterback storyline, to your point, is just there's not as much national media stuff going on about it. But these are also, you know, two newcomers to the Super Bowl. If it's the same thing next year, if we get Drake May, Sam Darnold too, there's going to be a lot of storylines about, you know, potential dynasties and that sort of thing. But I think this feels to me much like the Rams-Bengals Super Bowl in terms of two new teams to the formats. You know, obviously McVay had been there before, but new groups, except for the fact those two quarterbacks were much higher profile.
Yeah, what I'm alluding to with this one specifically in terms of what team I think is the most, or what game is the most like this one, I think is Super Bowl 50, right? You had Broncos versus Panthers. The Broncos defense was just electric, and they win that one 24-10. That kind of feels like something that could match the profile of this game when it comes to the Seahawks defense really just holding down the Patriots and the offense doing just enough to score, you know, 24-30 points and winning that one pretty handily. Does that feel pretty accurate to you?
Yeah, the other thing about that too is those were two really good defenses. That was Cam Newton's MVP season with Carolina. I believe that was that season. And it was a situation where, yeah, Cam Drake May comparison, obviously they don't play super similarly, but you know, two MVP considerates during the regular season, and then Cam was awesome in the postseason, but just ran into the best defense in the NFL and got his lunch ate a little bit. That was hardly his best game of the season. And yeah, that was the year where it was, you know, quarterback controversy all year for the Broncos. I can't even remember the guy they gave the job to over Peyton because he was just so old and beat up. Oh man, what was that guy's name? Was it like Brock Osweiler got the starting job that year and started in the playoffs, but was so bad? They literally gave Noodle Arm Peyton the ball because they're like, at least you're not going to turn it over. And he did just enough.
Oh, look, I'll pull it up.
I think it was Brock Osweiler. As that came to me, I feel pretty good about it. But yeah, that was a good defensive matchup, and it was a situation where, despite one team having the better quarterback, what mattered more was the better defense.
It was Osweiler, or unless you were thinking of Trevor Siemian, but I think it was probably Osweiler.
Yeah, it could have been either one of those. The important thing is, he didn't fucking matter, whoever it was. Osweiler, Siemian, all I'm sure about is they did not matter.
Well, anyways, let's jump to a little bit more discussion on the actual game itself. In my humble opinion, there's kind of three ways this game can go. There is in every game, there's four ways that it can go in general when we're going by the guidelines that I'm about to present to you. Is there a world where you think the Patriots just smack the absolute crap out of the Seahawks?
I mean, anything is possible. Them smacking this defense is pretty hard for me to imagine, but I could see a scenario where they get the ground game going and they're just, you know, Trayvon Henderson rips a couple big ones. You know, defending the run hasn't been the strong suit of this defense necessarily. And then the other factor there would be, you know, you get seeing ghosts. Sam Darnold turns the ball over four times, you know, two for scores, and it just kind of kills the Hawks' spirit. But I think it would have to be a very specific set of circumstances to lead to that.
I see. I am to the point where I don't even think that can happen. I think even if Sam Darnold turns the ball over three times, I think this defense will keep us in it, and it'll be even at that point, it'll be a 20-16 game or something like that. Like, I think there is almost no world where the Patriots win this game by more than 4 points, to be honest with you. And so that's the three other scenarios, right? You have the Seahawks smacking the Patriots around and winning by 15-20,
which is very easy to imagine. You get the same Drake that you've got the last 4 weeks. You get the same Sam Darnold, and the defense just eats.
Mm-hmm. And then you have a close Seahawks win where the defense, Sam Darnold doesn't really do anything, but the defense keeps them around, and they end up scoring just enough points to outlast a Patriots team that was really unable to get too much going offensively, or the Patriots win a close one. Those are kind of the three outcomes that I can see. In your head, what is the most likely one to come out of this game?
I think most likely is a close Seahawks win. I do think this will be far and away the best defense the Hawks have played in a number of weeks. You know, the Niners defense was rags and duct tape, and then the Rams defense was really good this year, but they just had a lot of injuries towards the end of the season and weren't the same unit they had been. You know, you saw that against the Bears. This Pats defense is really good, and I think right now, the three, obviously they're not all still playing, but the three best defenses in this 2025 season were pretty clearly to me the Seahawks, the Texans, and the Patriots. So it's a top three defense in my opinion. I do think that is going to limit what Sam Darnold can do, especially with an offense so heavily based around JSN. And then I do think, you know, and this is my great fear, is that Drake May will just actually play good in this one and, God forbid, lead them to a Super Bowl win, and then everyone's just going to forget how awful he was the first 3 weeks, and that would just break my heart. But yeah, I anticipate it being a closer game where both teams are able to move the ball a little bit, but defenses kind of go head-to-head, and maybe the difference maker is we have the best receiver in professional football.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is going to be a game where the Seahawks, it could be an exact mirror match score-wise of that, whatever it was, 2015 Super Bowl. That's the right one, right?
Is that 24? Where the Seahawks are winning. 20?
I think it was 24-20. I have it pulled up. Why don't I just look? 28-24. It was a four-point game. So I think it could be an exact mirror of that where the Seahawks win 28-24 and the NFL and all the media could just be like, wow, what a reversal by the Seahawks over the last decade. And it's just like, nah, we were built for this. But no, I think this is the type of game where there's going, it's crazy because on the betting sites, you know, FanDuel, stuff like that, you have both quarterbacks are actually more, their odds are that they're more likely to throw an interception than not, which I think is very interesting. I think it's indicative of what people think is going to be a lower scoring game.
The quality even of the two credit defenses.
Yeah. I think, what is it, like 5.5 touchdowns are kind of predicted overall?
Yeah, so something like that. Yeah, I do just think the way, you know, if you look at matchups to, you know, the Pats defense, they've obviously got one exceptional corner, but they're really just a great rushing defense. So I'm basically counting Kenneth Walker out for this one. He'll get some touches, but this is, I think we're going to have to pass to generate offense. And that just, you know, it makes you a little bit nervous to, like, really put the ball in Sam's hands and say, like, hey, you have to go do this if we're going to generate offense. That, you know, makes me a tiny bit nervous. And then on the other side, our defense is way more just, like, balanced. Like, we're very good at every level, but we're not unstoppable at any level. And I just worry if their running game gets going and that takes pressure off of Drake May, that just lets them have a bit more synergistic of a system. Now, we are the number one defense in the NFL, so I would not be surprised if we also just shut them down. But that my worry about how this could be close is, negative game script for our offense.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting line to me. It's like Kenneth Walker to have an anytime touchdown is -195, and I'm like, I want nothing to do with that. I think Kenneth Walker's going to have such a hard time scoring the football.
The touchdown props are absolutely ridiculous in this game. Do not take a touchdown prop. They're disgusting.
No.
I guess that's a great segue. Do you want to talk about some of our favorite props from the game?
I do. And I want to talk about one that is not available anymore because I got it really, really early. But there was a Drake May prop that was like to score a touchdown. And that was at plus 380 right when the game opened. And it's moved all the way to plus 270. And wow. I think what's happening is people are just throwing all of their money on touchdown scorers. And FanDuel or whoever you're using is like, hey, we could just keep lowering this and people will still keep betting it. Might as well.
So that's Drake May to get rushing Drake touchdown? May
to basically rush for a touchdown at plus 380. And I'm very, very comfortable with those odds.
Yeah, you obviously saw his one touchdown against the Broncos was using his legs. He's a guy that, in the red zone, likes to use his legs. So I think that's a great bet. Good job getting there early. Yeah, that line's been destroyed. I'm going to go back-to-back here. We're kind of, I guess I'll just say, we're kind of doing a value dogs thing. We're not taking underdogs, but we each picked three props we really like from the Super Bowl. I'm taking my emotional hedge double whammy, and this is my the Seahawks should win, but I'm terrified that the Patriots are going to, and neither one of these bets guarantees a Patriots win, but if these two things happen, if the Patriots win, these two things are very likely to happen, and even if the Patriots don't win, they still could, and that is, I like JSN under 94 receiving yards. It's about even money. That's just a huge number. Obviously, he's a monster. He's been doing that game to game. But they're going to be able to put one of the best corners in defense on him. And they're going to be able to focus most of their defense around him. And again, this is one of the best defenses in football we're playing. So I would not be surprised if JSN, you know, finishes with 70 yards. And maybe guys like Cooper Kupp pick up a little bit of slack. And then the other one I want to pair with that is Drake May over 221 passing yards. I do just think, you know, I could definitely see him struggling to get to that number, but, you know, the Seahawks could definitely win this game and give up 250 to Drake. But if Drake goes over 250, I should say, if they're going to beat the Seahawks, they kind of need him to go over 220. I don't see any way they win this game with him throwing for like a buck 80.
Yeah, no, I can get behind those lines. I think it's definitely a hedge your bet emotionally on like, hey, if this is going to happen, the Patriots need to,
And those are good lines, too. It's like that's a lot of receiving yards for a wide receiver, and that's not a lot of passing yards for a guy that, you know, is going to finish second in MVP voting.
Yeah, I think there's a world where, like you said, the Patriots' rushing game is really the thing that carries them through this one, but I think the Seahawks' rushing defense is better than we've been giving them credit for the last little bit, so... We'll see how it goes. Like they were the number one rushing defense, I believe by some metrics. I think their second halves have been a little bit worrisome. Is where they've kind of shown some weaknesses. But that is also could be attributed to just getting tired and you know playing the Rams leads to a lot of running around that you're not expecting when you're playing Puka Nacua and things like that. So we'll see how that shapes up. One of the lines that I really 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 like is a Rashid Shaheed alt receiving yard total, because I do think JSN is going to get bottled up pretty handily by Christian Gonzalez. I think that's going to be a really nice matchup. And if they do that, I think Rashid Shaheed is like a lot of people have been talking about Cooper Kupp and kind of the underside of the defense and him having a good game. But Rashid Shaheed's just like even odds are around basically like 23 yards. And if Rashid Shaheed is going to get yards in this game, you should just bet 50+. And so Rashid Shaheed for 50+ yards is at plus 400. I think that's a really good bargain. I think that's one that you should be taking.
I love that with a guy like Rashid, where it's like, that's one reception is what that is.
Yeah, but
it's
he just, literally had that really in one reception last week.
Yeah, zero or one receptions is what you're talking about there. And to get plus, you know, 400 odds on one reception is I think, pretty great. Yeah, those speedsters, man, they're hard to set lines for sure. Do you have another one, or do you want me to go?
I do. I'll rip one off real quick. We've got we were talking about how Kenneth Walker might not have a big game, and I think the rushing attack is going to struggle a little bit. But I think the passing attack could be where Kenneth Walker shines. I think some, you know, we throw him at Milton Williams enough times, and eventually Milton Williams will try and tackle him or get so distracted by Sam Darnold on a bootleg that Kenneth Walker is going to get lost. And I think there's a few options here, but I like Kenneth Walker to have it's the 3.5 reception line is kind of the line there. So I like him to have 4+ receptions with plus 178 odds. I think there's going to be a lot of screens, a lot of dump offs, by Sam Darnold just because he's under pressure. I think Kenneth Walker is going to have, at the very least, the opportunity to have receptions. I'm not talking yards, just receptions, and maybe he gets 1 or 2 yards on those plays. But the fact that he's going to be open on a pass pro or something like that after blocking for a second or getting a little bit of time for those screens, we know how Kubiak likes to run this offense. I really like plus 178 odds for 4 receptions.
Nice. I dig that. Yeah, I could see. And that's a way to use him, who's obviously a very valuable player, in a way that might be more effective against this running defense. So I think that'd be very smart. One I like, this is my Sam Darnold ultimate parlay. I feel pretty good about this one. If you parlay his over 1.5 passing touchdowns and his yes to throw an interception, that gives you odds of about plus 170, almost 2-1. And I just think, first of all, yes, he's going to throw an interception. I think these pair so nicely together because, again, he's going to have to throw the ball a lot. I would not be surprised to see him throw the ball 35 times in this game, just with how good the Patriots' rush defense is. And if you're going to do that, he's going to make one mistake and throw an interception. I think that's going to happen. And then, you know, even in the red zone, I do not anticipate the Seahawks scoring a rushing touchdown. I just don't think it's going to happen. They're going to have to take it to the air. And I think Darnold's going to get in twice.
Yeah, I can get behind that. I think you're, especially if he is throwing the ball 35 times, like, you're expecting Darnold to have an interception there, like you're saying. Like, he threw 14 interceptions this season. Like, that, you're expecting an interception against a good defense like the Patriots, especially in the secondary level. Especially if he's trying to fit the ball to JSN against a Christian Gonzalez type back. Like, that's the kind of thing where we talked about that last week, even, where it was like, hey, if he's going to try and get the ball to JSN 10 times this game, Christian Gonzalez is going to intercept one of those. Like, that's just how that's going to happen, or a safety's going to come through. But Sam Darnold is not a perfect passer. And so because of that, I think taking that interception, and I like the adding the 2 touchdowns there, I think you're getting something where it's like, yeah, this is the kind of thing that the Seahawks are going to have to do to win this game. And Sam Darnold, he had, you know, was it? Yeah, it was 3 passing touchdowns in that game against the Rams. Like, it's fully possible that we hit Jake Bobo and Rashid Shaheed for two touchdowns in this game. Like, that's very, very feasible.
And, you know, I'm not saying we're going to score buckets and buckets of points, but I think the idea is, even if it's, you know, first and three, you know, first and goal from the 3, I would not be surprised if we threw it 3 times in a row, because I really have a lot of respect for this Pats pass rush and run defense. So I think they're going to be pretty stout up front.
Let me just, so we're talking, you know, throwing it from the 3-yard line. Let me put out into the world the bet on Eric Saubert to have an anytime touchdown, which is crazy, actually. Never mind. I just saw this line. I was just thinking, oh, this would be a great one to have. These touchdown lines are insane. What are we doing here? It's only plus 1,000. It's 10-1 for Eric Saubert, the guy who caught 1 2-point conversion on the entire season, to have a touchdown in this game.
That's terrible.
What are we doing?
He doesn't have a touchdown on the year.
That's the kind of guy. He's like a third. He's our third string tight end, and the guy has plus 1,000 odds. What are we doing here?
We need to form our own sports book, dude. This is getting ridiculous. The touchdown odds are just so out of whack.
That's insane. Cam Akers is plus 1,800. Cam Akers plays for the Seahawks. Did you know that?
Bro, I 100% thought Cam Akers was on the Pats when you said that. That's crazy. I did not know he was on the Hawks. Plus 1,800. Has he gotten a carry this year?
I think he's gotten like 1 or 2. The odds are just insane for this game.
Yeah, it messed up, man.
Ugh. All right, we've been on here for about an hour, and we haven't actually talked about what we think the real outcome of this game is going to be. We've talked about the potential for it, but I think it's time we both gave our picks. And then we can probably end the pod. I think that's going to be the last thing we do, unless you have anything else you want to do. Do you want to go first, or do you want me to?
That's plenty. I'll go first. I'm fighting off the dark thoughts. The Seahawks are better than this Patriots team. They don't have to do too much. They just have to get up early and then just control the game script, which I think they're fully capable of. I am saying, I'm going to say 24-10 Seahawks. I'm going to say 24-17 Seahawks.
Wow. 24-10. You were about to just exactly match that Broncos-Panthers game that we talked about earlier. You were like, let me change it up.
I can't do it.
Well, I can, but I'm going to go 24-13. I think this Patriots offense is just going to be dumbfounded. I think Drake May is not, like, he's going to be the one seeing ghosts at the end of this game. I think this is going to be a Seahawks defense does plenty and they end up winning by 11 points in this game, and it is just a Seahawks defensive palooza. We get an interception, we get a fumble recovery, we get four or five sacks. Like, I'm expecting a lot of great things coming from this Seahawks defense, and Sam Darnold to do just enough. Maybe that's going to hurt your two touchdown line, but at the end of the day, I really like what the Seahawks defense has been able to do. And Drake May, for as good as he's been as an MVP candidate, he is a second-year quarterback going up against the best defense in the league. And as we've seen throughout this playoffs, he's not necessarily performed well against good defenses. He's just been kind of very mid to bad. And this is the time for a team that has a competent offense to do something about that. So I think the Seahawks win this game pretty handily, to be honest.
I love that. If we can get in one of those game scripts where Sam Darnold throws it like four times in the second half, I would be incredibly happy. Side bets be damned. Like, if Drake May's crying on the sidelines at any point, I'm going to sleep like a baby.
Can we get odds on Drake May crying on the sidelines at any point during this game?
He's an emotional guy.
Is that on the sports books?
You can bet on Gatorade, but not on tears. Ridiculous.
Yeah, I think Sam Darnold is either going to have to throw the ball 35 times or he's going to throw it like 23 times and get kind of a 17 for 23 type game. And it's just going to be like, hey, we're just moving the ball slowly but surely. But there's not really a situation where I think he's like, if you're going to take a completions or a pass attempts, you either take under 25 or you take over 35. Like, there's no middle ground for this game. So I like that discussion.
Yeah, I appreciate
it. All right, John. The Super Bowl is in 3 days, man. The Super Bowl is in 3 days, and we are locked in. Get excited. For John Kerry, I'm Tyler Cartwright. This has been the Sound Up Seattle podcast. If you enjoyed this episode of Sound Up Seattle, please feel free to drop a like, subscribe, drop a follow. If you're listening on any podcast platforms, we are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find Sound Up Seattle on Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram, all at Sound Up Seattle, all lowercase, all one word. You can find me, Tyler. No, you can email us questions, comments, concerns about our gambling discussion at soundupseattle@gmail.com. You can find me, Tyler, at TyCart50 everywhere that's important. And you can find John.
Stop trying to find me. The season's almost over. Stop looking for me. Just let me live in peace. Go Hawks.
All right, let's go Hawks, baby. Been waiting to get that takeoff.
Since I left this town.